The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands and millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day four, actually quite a bit through day four, more than halfway through day four. And at the beginning of day four, we're halfway through the Sesshin. So that means we're close to halfway at this point, because this is the special Sesshin that goes into the eighth day. This being Rohatsu Sesshin in December 2017 here at Mountain Gate. And Rohatsu, as you already know, is a special commemorative Sesshin that is held every year all over the world in different monasteries and temples, Buddhist monasteries and temples, in honor of the Buddha's own awakening. And the fact that in having that experience and doing all the work that was entailed in moving up towards it and finally actualizing it and fine-tuning his work with people for 40 years after that, that that teaching has been able to come down to us today so that we also can have the very same experience. Now, that said, everyone's personal experience of Kensho, or seeing into the true nature of things, varies a great deal. It depends on how deep it is, it depends on their personality and the framework through which they come to that insight. And of course, what the Buddha realized was a much deeper awakening experience than people normally have. And so it underscores the necessity of continuing practice to have increasingly deeper insights, increasingly deeper awakening experiences. And each one refines and expands what we have opened to before. Zen Master Hakuin, who had 19 major Kensho experiences and countless minor ones, discovered that some of his earlier Kensho experiences really put him off track, that they weren't as accurate as his later deeper openings allowed him to realize. So something to take note of. One single Kensho is certainly not enough for anybody, two or three even. It's important to have ongoing deepening practice. That is the Rinzai way. We'll continue, as is traditional in Rinzai monasteries this time of year, to share Master Hakuin's Rohatsu exhortations. They aren't always as relevant to current day practice, but in terms of honoring the man who single-handedly resurrected Rinzai Zen and made it possible really for this teaching to come down to us in somewhat more modern version, we go ahead and share it anyway. Hakuin himself ran into a number of difficult times in his own practice. He learned kind of the hard way how to practice. And it took him some effort, and it took him some times where he had to readjust how he practiced. Because in the beginning, he was striving, knocking everything else out of the water, and just striving in his practice. And that doesn't really work. It's a more expansive, more relaxed way of practicing, and yet deeply focused, both deeply focused and deeply expansive, which is what the Sasokan, the extended out-breath, will make possible for us. And that's why this is the primary practice of Rinzai Zen. So this is his exhortation on the fourth night. The master said, this is translated by Norman Waddell, the breathing exercise, Sasokan, is composed of six wondrous entrances to enlightenment. The first, called Su, is counting the breaths and entering samadhi. Mastering it, you merge with your inhalations and exhalations and enter into samadhi, reaching the next entrance called Zui, following the breath. The breathing exercise is explained as having 16 different characteristics as well, but in the end, they all return to the first two, the practices of counting and of following the breath. And we only count long enough until we have trained our mind to be able to focus with sufficient dedication on the experience of breathing out. After that, we abandon the counting, and instead, what we work with as we are extending the out-breath is this, whatever it is that brought us to practice to begin with. The need to understand something deeper, the need to return to something precious that you've lost track of somehow, and that is really important to return to. Or a fundamental question, is there a profound underlying truth that is always true no matter what the circumstances? This was Flora Courtois' question. Or, like some people, why is there suffering in the world? And for some others, we're born and we die. Is that it? We have however many years in between, and then it's all over? Isn't there something more? Or for others, where did I come from? One of our California students remembered as a toddler, he was so young he was still sleeping in his crib, and he remembers seeing the bars of the crib and lying on his back with his chubby little feet up in the air, wondering how he got into that body. Where'd he come from? And he continued deeply questioning that. And of course, initially, it very likely was a question that came before words. He kept on, and eventually he asked his mother the question, and she gave some sort of answer that he knew was not correct. He knew that she didn't know. And he kept on, and he kept on. And he even remembers going out in the yard and crossing his legs. And suddenly, he realized that he was perfect, lacking nothing, just as he was. It was a profound and deep experience, far more than the words can really express. And it was very clear that that had been a genuine awakening experience for him that lasted for a long time, because this young man had the unfortunate karma to be born into a family that was abusive. And not only abusive, but also involved in drugs. In fact, both his parents ended up in federal prison for transporting drugs internationally. And for a while, he had some serious conditioning around being basically both physically and emotionally abused. But as he came to Zen practice and continued doing the Zen practice, he transformed. And at his funeral, his aunt said, doing the practice at the Zen Center there brought him to become the man he always was. When he first came to the center, there were several people who said, this guy's not right here. I don't want him here. He was pretty rough, loud, boisterous, and still had a lot of habit energy from his growing up. And they said, it's either him or us. And I said, I'm sorry, what you want to do more likely is understand where he's coming from. And they stayed, and he stayed. and the transformation was remarkable, and they came to dearly love him. Unfortunately, he died young. But it's also a remarkable story about the power of commitment that doesn't depend on simply one life. Buddhism teaches that there's no beginning to life and no end to it. And this thing that we call being born and dying is in name only. But we have to be careful about that because we can get some wrong ideas about it. It's clear that at some level in some previous life he had been dedicated to practice. But you may not agree. That's okay. Thus it was that the first Zen patriarch, the great Bodhidharma, said, "Stop all external connections. Have no concerns within. Make the mind a stone wall and enter into the great way." Now, what that really means is not to set up barriers against hearing, seeing, thinking, feeling, and so on. It means not to get involved in anything, inward or outward, other than this deep, all-abiding search for the truth. Where did we come from before we were born? And where will we go after we die? Or will we go anywhere? Did we just pop out of the birth stream with no beginning? We all know how children are conceived and the gestation period that follows normally. But if you've ever seen a child born or met that child just within a few hours of birth, you know that that child already is a person. Where did that person come from? The body we know all about. A couple of cells meet, join, expand, multiply, differentiate, and voila, you have a little person, or at least a little body. But the personality, the energy that drives that body, the life stream, where did that come from? Where is it now within us? It's important to reconnect to that fundamental question that you have that brought you to practice. Because that is one of the most important things. And you bring that yearning, that need to know, that curiosity, however you would phrase it, into the out-breath. And as you extend the out-breath, you pour all that yearning into it and you reach through the breath for the answer. Talking about it doesn't get you anywhere. Thinking about it doesn't get you anywhere either. So what does get you somewhere? Allowing yourself to search beyond words. Relentlessly, through boredom, through frustration, through excitement, through misunderstanding, through makyo, through aching legs and tired back, through long hours of yasa, late night sitting, persisting, and results will come. Having no concerns within means not relying on the fundamental source. Quite sure what he really means by this, because what we're really doing is searching for our fundamental source. Making the mind a stone wall means going straight ahead, which is not going left, not going right. You hear something and immediately can trigger a thought about it. Ignore that. Just stay with the question. Just stay with the extended out breath. Take it as far out as you can without gasping and reach through that breath in faith that the answer will appear if you persist long enough and without constant distraction, because you have to give it 100% of your attention. This is why the extended out-breath, the Sasokan, is so vital, because in order to extend the out-breath, you have to pay attention. And in having to pay attention, you have to let go other concerns. This is its gift. This verse of the first patriarch is exceedingly profound. You should make it a fundamental koan. Strive for all you're worth to take it right straight ahead. If you do, your kensho is assured. You can be more certain of that than you can of reaching down and feeling the ground at your feet. Strive hard, strive hard. And then I'd like to share with you some more of the letters of Dawei. Dawei Zonggao, the Chinese, Chan master of the 11th century, whose teaching was profound. And this is his third letter to Wang Nihan. I hear that your fifth son has passed away from illness. The affection between father and son flows for 1,000 lives and 100 eons through the habitual forces of human attachment, so I fear that there's nothing you can do about your present state of mind. But if in whatever you do bear in mind that in this world of the five impurities, all is illusory and nothing is true, then as the days and months go by, these feelings will gradually fade away. When feelings of grief arise, look closely into the source from which they emerge. When feelings of grief arise, look closely into the source from which they emerge. If you're unable to reach this source, then examine where that which is at this very moment is grieving comes from. Look constantly into whether this grieving is existent or non-existent, whether it is empty or real, till the mind has nowhere left to go. If you want to think, just think. If you want to weep, just weep. Weep as much as you like, think as much as you like. Once one has shaken out and exhausted the many habitual energies of human affection found in the storehouse consciousness, one simply returns to the original state without affliction, and without thought, without sorrow, and without joy, like ice naturally returning to water when it melts. It may sound like you're sort of forgetting the whole thing and going blank. That's not the case. When we reach deeply within, when we trace down the source of the grief, and this does not mean, of course, I'm sad because my son has died. That's got nothing to do with that. Where is the one who is grieving? Keep working on it, and you will find that the son is just as alive as the father. And never went anywhere. To be truly in the world is none other than to have truly left the world. The law of the world is the Buddha law, and the Buddha law is the law of the world. Father and child are by nature one. Is it possible that a father could lose a child and not grieve for or have thoughts of the child? Or that a child could lose a father and not grieve for or have thoughts of him? If one forcibly prevents oneself from weeping or thinking when it is only natural to do so, then one is opposing natural law and harming one's inherent nature. It is like shouting at an echo to silence it, or pouring oil on a fire to put it out. To feel emotions is not something separate from enlightenment. so do not try to see it as something apart from you. Yongjia Xuanzhe said, the true nature of ignorance is Buddha nature. The empty body of illusory transformation is the Dharma body. These words are true, not lies and deceptions. If you understand things in this way, you will not lose yourself in thought and emotions, even if you try to. To see in this way is known as true contemplation. Other types of seeing are false contemplation. When you have yet to distinguish true from false, that is precisely the time to be diligent in your practice. This is truly the correct way, as I have determined it. Do not speak of this in front of ignorant people. There was, some years back, in Rochester at least, and that was the only experience that I had in terms of any Zen community, and I suspect it was that way all over the United States. There was this assumption that if you were a real Zen person, you didn't have any feelings at all. Well, this is not at all the case. It's not at all accurate. There was a story of the master whose most promising student died young. And one day, soon after, his monks found him crying. And they were shocked and dismayed. Zen master crying? And they said, what's going on? I thought you were a Zen master. And he said, if I didn't cry when my most promising student died young, when would I ever cry? To truly do Zen practice means to truly feel. At the same time, in order to reach a level of understanding where the feelings won't throw us off course, won't derail us, but are real in terms of the depth of feeling that we feel, we have to go for a while into a more, let's say narrow way of exploration. And it's in a more narrow focus, let's put it that way. And the extended out breath makes that possible. As we extend that out breath, we have to focus, as we already said. And we cannot use it, this is very important, we cannot use it to escape feelings. This is not what it's meant to be used for. In the middle of the grief, pour the grief into the out-breath, the energy of the grief. Stay out of the story. It's just a story. But the energy of the grief, pour it into the out-breath. Reach. It can bring you, really, to awakening. If you work with it in that way, if you use it in that way. There's nothing wrong with human feeling. It makes us human, after all. So now on this fourth day, almost into the fifth day of Sesshin, we want to redouble our efforts to focus more completely, to expand our awareness so that when we're out and about, we are fully engaged in exactly what we're doing without distraction. And when we're in the Zendo, we're giving ourselves every moment to extending that out breath filled with the curiosity of that innate koan, whether it's a natural koan or whether it's searching for our face before our parents were born, whether it's the koan mu, whether it's the sound of one hand, or whether it's simply our own, as I said, natural koan. The important thing is the yearning to know, to find out, to answer, to reach deep within and discover who we really are. And to know and taste personally the freedom that comes from that. So continue on. Sesshin has gone strongly so far. Don't let up. Don't let up. This is important. No matter what we feel like we're coming up against, embrace it. Allow yourself to feel the energy of it and drop deep within, searching for that truth. Thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.